or have another print disability, which makes reading, holding a book, or turning a page difficult or impossible. The content is copyrighted by the respective publishers. For more information, please visit us on the web at nfradioreading.org.
Hello, this is Janice Marie Hunt, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the August 13th, 2026 issue of the East Aurora Advertiser on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Starr appointed to Iroquois School Board. Lisa Starr was appointed to the Iroquois Central School District Board of Education and took the oath of office during a special meeting at 8 a.m. on August 5th. Starr fills a vacancy created by the resignation of Henry S.Z.Y.M.U.L.A. III, who was elected in 2025 to a five-year term. Rather than hold a special election, the board chose to appoint a replacement to serve until the next election for the seat. If Starr wishes to remain on the board, she must run for election in May 2027. Superintendent Doug Schofield said two board seats will appear next spring on that ballot. The candidate receiving the most votes will earn a five-year term, while the second-place finisher will complete the remaining three years of SZYMULA unexpired term. Starr, who finished second in the 2025 school board election, is service coordinator at Great Lakes Building Systems, Inc. A graduate of Iroquois High School, she holds a bachelor and master's degree in meteorology and atmospheric science, as well as a master's degree in secondary science education. She previously taught earth science at Iroquois High School before returning to her family's business. Starr said during her 2025 campaign that she wanted to help maintain the district's strong academic standards while supporting students, staff, and taxpayers. Former town clerk hired as assistant to the supervisor. Former Aurora town clerk Martha Librock has been appointed by the town board to serve as temporary assistant to the supervisor following the resignation of Kathleen Moffitt last Friday. She was appointed unanimously by the board at the August 10th meeting, with Councilmember Jessica Armworth absent for the meeting. MOFA also serves as the town's budget officer and oversees the town's investments. She resigned to take a new position elsewhere. Her last day with the town will be August 21st. Kathleen will be sorely missed. Supervisor Charles Snyder said she always treated every penny in that budget as if it was her own. Recreation Director Chris Mussenhoffen said that Moffitt was a support to him and taught him a lot at the town. Librock spent 27 years as town clerk following her retirement in 2025. She was hired by the town to help with the transition of the incoming clerk, Jeannie Vigor. Librock will earn a rate of $31.27 per hour. Librock will serve in the role until a permanent replacement is appointed. Snyder said that the town would begin advertising for a permanent position immediately because it is unaware of many applicants the town will receive before the end of the year. The position is appointed by the supervisor, and with a contested election for the supervisor's office coming in November, there is no guarantee of job security past December 31st. Wow. The budget development process for the 2027 fiscal year already begun, with the town board adopting the budget calendar at the July 27th meeting and the first public meeting held with department heads on August 12th. The Aurora Town Board will meet for a week session at 6:30 p.m. Tuesday, August 18th at a regular board meeting at 6:30 p.m. August 24th. Elm Street Retail Project tabled by applicant. The application for a 4,400 square foot retail structure to be constructed on Elm Street in East Aurora has been tabled by applicant Roger Andrews, citing the need to provide additional documentation. The application for use variance to construct the building was tabled at the East Aurora Zoning Board of Appeals, ZBA, meeting in July as the applicant claimed financial hardship as a condition for the variance but did not have any financial documents detailing the hardship present at the meeting. The application was scheduled to be discussed at the August 13th meeting and will now appear at the September 20th meeting of the ZBA. Members of the public will still have the opportunity to provide comments regarding the project. The public comment period of the August 13th meeting, which begins at 6 p.m. The comments will be entered into the public record. The application will not be discussed at the board level. The ZBA will meet at 6 p.m. Thursday, 7:10 at the Aurora Municipal Center on Oakwood. East Aurora resident sues sewer district over damage. East Aurora resident Nathaniel Wayman has filed a lawsuit against the Erie County Sewer District No. 8, alleging failure to maintain its municipal sewer line and the WYE pipe connection located near his property following a sewage blockage that occurred on his property, costing him over $10,000 to repair. The lawsuit was filed with the Erie County Supreme Court on June 24th. Wayman's suit alleges that the WYE pipe, a connector fitting that joins the homeowner's sewer to the municipal sewer main, was an integral component of the municipal sewer main and root intrusion cause. The WYE pipe to crack and break. Wayman alleges his resident experienced a sewer blockage in October 2025 and contacted a local plumbing company to provide an estimate for excavation and repair of the main sewer line in the street. The scope of work included saw cutting and removing existing blacktop, excavation to expose the damaged main, remove and dispose of damaged piping, and installation of approximately 10 linear inches of new pipe with fitting and backfill, as well as blacktop repair. A technician from the plumbing company was dispatched on November 6, 2025 to confirm the location of the sewer line, and the problem area was marked. The excavation occurred on November 13th, and during the process, an inspector from Erie County Sewer District No. 8 was contacted and arrived on location that afternoon. The inspector observed the damage to the WYE pipe providing guidance and was present supervising the repair of the damage in its entirety. After excavation, the plumbing company discovered the damage was to the main line WYE pipe, not the Wayman's private building sewer. The fitting had roots penetrating through it. The backside of the WYE was blown apart and was cracked all the way to the main. Photographic evidence was taken before the damaged WYE was removed and the repair was completed. On or about February 9, 2026, within 90 days of the occurrence, a property damage claim form was served to the Erie County Department of Law's Property Damage Department. The letter stated a contractor was hired for sewer line repair, and upon uncovering the failure being in the main line, not the pipe connecting from the house. A letter from the department dated February 18th allegedly denied Wayman's claim, stating that the district did not have proper knowledge of the blockage and thus cannot be liable. Wayman's claim notes that the denial letter does not dispute that the damage was to the main line WYE pipe. The lawsuit alleges that WAYMAN was conducting a ministerial duty to maintain and repair the municipal sewer system to avoid injury to abutting property owners and the public, and the sewer district breached their duty of care by failing to adequately maintain, inspect, and repair the main line. Continuation. According to the lawsuit, the negligence includes failing to implement an adequate program of regular inspection, jetting, and camera surveying of the main sewer line and WYE connections. The lawsuit also alleges that the county's prior written notice law is not applicable to the incident, as it makes no reference to sewers, sewer mains, or subsurface structures. Under New York law, prior written notice statutes that do not expressly sewers are inapplicable to claims involving subsurface sewer infrastructure, the lawsuit alleges. The lawsuit seeks reimbursement for the cost of the repairs and alleges that it would be against equity and good conscience to permit the sewer district to retain the benefit of the repaired sewer without doing so. In total, the lawsuit seeks compensatory damages in an amount to be determined at trial, but no less than $10,875 plus interest from November 13th, 2025, restitution in the amount of $10,875 plus interest, November 13th costs, and the disbursement of the action, and such other and further relief as this court deems just and proper. At the time of publication, the Erie County Sewer District No. 8 has not responded to the lawsuit, and there are no additional documents available to the public other than the summons and complaint. The Sewer District serves the village of East Aurora and portions of the town of Aurora. Friends of Knox Garden Club restores grandeur to mansion, guest house gardens. If you notice that the gardens at the mansion and the guest house at Knox Farm State Park have been looking colorfully, bountifully lately, plan a visit for any Thursday morning from April to November to find out why. There you'll see as many as 30 volunteers planting, mulching, weeding, trimming, deadheading, watering, whatever it takes to keep up the extensive planting that designed by landscaper designer Ellen Riddy Shipman were the envy of Buffalo society almost a century ago. Thanks to the efforts of the Friends of Knox Farm Garden Club, they once again offer beautiful weddings, special events, and serenity and joy for the casual visitor. Last Thursday, advertiser photographer Marty Wengling and I were invited by Karen Swift Jones of the Knox Garden Club to see the gardeners in action. Before we left, an hour later, we were duly amazed by the extent of the efforts these volunteers put into their work. On 30 planting beds, Last Thursday, advertiser photographer Marty Wangland and I invited by Karen Swift Jones of the Knox Garden Club to see the gardeners in action. Before we left an hour later, we were duly amazed by the extent of the efforts these volunteers put into their work on 30 planting beds, a birch tree grove, and an understory leading up to the mansion. Last year alone, according to our garden club bio, volunteers contributed over 1,000 hours of labor, worth many thousands of dollars, and making the Knox Farm Gardens a popular destination. Jones met me at the mansion for our visit last week, and soon we were joined by friends of Knox Garden Club coordinator Lisa Sheffield and co-coordinator Joanne Reeves. We began on our tour at the front entrance to the former grand summer home of Seymour Knox II and his wife Helen, and later Seymour Knox III and his wife Jean, before it sailed to New York State in 2000. Working the beds in front of the mansion was Cindy Norton. "Many of our gardeners adopt a particular bed as theirs," Jones said. "Others may help out, but they take the responsibility for planting and maintaining it." "When work began on these beds in 2019, said Sheffield, "it was just a bunch of mixed ground covers and ferns that would die off by July. And brown and crispy for weddings, not a good look." We had only 4 volunteers at that time and 1 state worker. Cindy has adopted this bed as her own and has been incorporating some of what was here, some of her own ideas, and some of what the original landscape architect, Ellen Biddy Shipman, had in mind with help from Murray Brothers. It's a collaborative process with all of us having some input and all of us helping each other. The idea is this planting will have flowers blooming throughout the season as welcome to those entering or just enjoying a walk. In the center of the circular drive in front of the mansion is a separate garden with a marble bench that honors the late Betsy Schwartz Graves, a former park resident and supporter of the Friends. Gardener Laura White maintains the peaceful spot with help from Graves' daughter, Carly, who is a Friends of Knoxport member, Joe Matucci, installed the walkway. We continue our tour counterclockwise around the mansion, stopping next at the Zen Garden, a quiet spot with a door into the house, particularly hidden behind lattice work. Traditionally, Schofield said this is the place where a groom has his first look at the bride in her dress. They will have a private moment, just the two of them. Ooh. Garden spans the extensive length of the back mansion, well over 100 feet with this panoramic view to the southwest. There is a stand of lilacs, a row of pignons, and a pet cemetery, pignons of varied heights and colors, plus a separate space for kitchen herbs. There must have been an 8 woman working these beds in the 80 plus degree sun. At the center of this planting are 2 sections of boxwood, elegant hedge plants often found in formal gardens, but recently threatened by the invasive box tree moth, which can devastate whole plantings in a short decline and certain demise, said a Golden Club history written by Sheffield. As created by an opportunity to restore the beds along the back of the mansion, more authentically recruiting what Biddy Shipman had planted so long ago. We are currently working with the horticulturist Emma Hahn, head gardener at Frank Lloyd Wright's Graycliff. Emma is knowledgeable in the intricacies of interpreting gardening and guiding thoughtful restorations because so few of her genes remain intact. Each preserved garden holds significant cultural value. Garden tourism is thriving in Buffalo, and Knox Farm has the potential to become an important part of the story. Across from that is what once the centerpiece of the mansion paintings, The Secret Garden After the Children's Book by Frances Burnett. One a formal garden, it has gone through many iterations, producing everything from vegetables to roses. Several garden club members have adopted parts of the Secret Garden as restoration to the original. Shipman Design continues the raised bed and hedges provided color all season, and the gazebo gift from the East Aurora Driving Society has become a popular place to sit and reflect or relax. As we made our way to the guest house, we passed through the understory, a wooded glade, as well as the birch grove, a sheltered area, mature white birches, where many couples hold their wedding ceremonies. The guest house once home to Northam Knox and family, and now a 5-bedroom rental, perfect for wedding partying, lodging on site, has its own gardens and its own adoptive parent, in this case, Joanne Reeves. Cheerful stressed that the club has grown from a handful to about 30. We can always use more, she said. We are grateful for the help we get from East Aurora High School students on their community service days and from National Fuel, who sends our volunteers and supports us financially, and the Boy Scouts. We really love when people show up to help, but there is always plenty to do for additional volunteers. We work very hard, but it's also a good time. Come join us. The Knox Estate Garden is on Facebook. So many questions, so many ticks. Welcome to Tick Time, a community Q&A column dedicated to helping readers better understand how to prevent tick bites, Lyme disease, and other tick-borne diseases. Each week, we'll answer real questions submitted by members of our community about prevention, symptoms, testing, treatment, considerations, outdoor safety, and life after a bite. As tick populations and diseases continue to expand across Western New York, many families are encountering ticks in their own backyards, parks, trails, and recreational areas. Unfortunately, confusion and misinformation about tick-borne diseases remain common. This column aims to provide practical, easy-to-understand information drawn from established educational resources, current research, and real-world experience. It is not medical advice. What kind of ticks are we dealing with in Western New York, and do they all carry Lyme disease? When most people hear tick, they think of Lyme disease, but that is only part of the story. Western New York has several ticks we need to recognize, and they don't all carry the same diseases. The deer tick, the black-legged tick, is our major Lyme disease vector. It can also transmit babesiosis, Borrelia, and other diseases, Powassan virus. Its nymph can be approximately the size of a poppy seed, which helps explain why so many people never remember seeing the tick that bit them. The American dog tick is larger and can transmit Rocky Mountains spotted fever and tularemia. The increasingly important Lone Star tick It's an aggressive tick that actively moves toward potential hosts rather than simply waiting for one to brush by. It is associated with ehrlichiosis and tularemia and STAR, and its bite can trigger alpha-gal syndrome, an allergic to mammal meat and other mammal-derived products. Wow. New York has also documented the invasive Asian longhorn tick. Unlike most ticks, females can reproduce without mating and can lay enormous numbers of eggs, allowing populations to multiply rapidly. Its role in transmitting human disease in the United States continues to be investigated. And what about BART? What's that? This is one I want readers to know about, because Bartonella changed my family's life. Three of our four children were bitten by ticks and later tested positive for Bartonella. Our youngest daughter was only six, and she was at Hamlin Park in East Aurora. She had gone out for ice cream with friends and stopped at the park on the way home for what should have been harmless fun. That was in 2014. I found what looked like a blackhead in her ear at bedtime, but she was six. Panic set in. It was something I had never seen, a nymph's tick, size of a poppy seed. We removed it with super pointed tweezers, treated her promptly for Lyme after her bite, but Bartonella was missed. She later developed such severe shin and leg pain that she spent an entire summer in a wheelchair. Oh, wow. You might have seen her in a red, white, blue wheelchair in one of East Aurora's July 3rd parades. Our son also became seriously ill, including an enlarged spleen. Both children developed striking red scratch-like scan markings on their backs associated with clinically with their Bartonella illnesses. Ooh. And this distinction matters. Treating Lyme does not necessarily mean Bartonella has been contracted or, more importantly, treated. Bartonella is a different bacteria infection and may require a different diagnostic and treatment approach. There remains disagreement within medicine about ticks and Bartonella. ILADS includes Bartonella among important infections encountered in patients with Lyme and tick-borne illnesses. And I published research has detected Bartonella DNA in ticks. Experimental research has also demonstrated vector competency in some tick models. Other medical authorities, including CDC and IDSA, maintain that tick-to-human transmission has not yet been conclusively established. Please err on the side of caution. For families like mine, that scientist debate isn't an abstract one. The important message for readers is not to assume that every illness following a tick bite must be Lyme, or that treating Lyme automatically addresses everything else that may be occurring. Watch especially for unexplained fever, profound fatigue, neurological or cognitive changes, severe headaches, unusual pain, particularly shin, foot, or bone pain, SWOL, lymph nodes, vision problems, or unusual red or purplish skin markings. These symptoms aren't diagnostic of Bartonella by themselves, but they deserve medical attention and BART consideration. One tick, more than one possible infection, that's why knowing matters. I sent my tick for testing. What do the results actually tell me? A tick test can tell you much more than whether the tick carries Lyme disease, but there is something important I want readers to understand first. Don't assume You should wait for the tick test results before talking with your health care provider about prophylactic treatment. The International Lyme and Associated Diseases Society, ILADS, recommends that prophylaxis is being discussed following all the black leg tick bites when the decision is made to use antibiotic prophylaxis, and there are no contradictions. ILADS recommends 2 doses of doxycycline and recommends against the single 200 milligram dose of doxycycline, sometimes preserved following a tick bite. That conversation can begin while the tick is at the laboratory. So why test the tick? Because it may tell you what else you were potentially exposed to. The report picture with this week's column is a real example from my own family. A female deer tick bit my husband in Erie County this past April when he did not tuck in pants or spray before heading onto Easter Road Woods. We sent the tick to technology for its universal tick test. The results surprised us. It tested positive for Lyme, but positive for Anaplasma. Ooh. The results surprised us. It tested negative for Lyme, but positive for Anaplasma, the bacterium that causes anaplasmosis. The laboratory uses PCR-based tests to look for genetic material for multiple pathogens. Depending upon the testing panel, that can include organisms associated with Lyme disease, anaplasmosis, Babesiosis, cirrhosis, relapsing fever, Bartonella, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and other rickettsial diseases and tularemia. There is also an important distinction between exposure and diagnosis. A positive result means the pathogen was detected in the tick. It does not prove that it was transmitted to the person who was biting, and tick testing isn't a substitute for medical evaluation or appropriate patient testing. But imagine the difference that information can make without testing my husband's tick. We might have been focused solely on Lyme disease. Instead, we know that the tick that actually bit him contained anaplasma. We could take that report to his healthcare provider and have a much more informed conversation about potentially exposure symptoms to watch for and appropriate care. That's why my advice after a known bite remains: remove the tick correctly, save it, document the date and location of the band. That conversation can begin while the tick is at the laboratory. So why test the tick? Because it may tell you what else you were potentially exposed to. The report pictured with this week's column is a real example from my own family. A female deer tick bit my husband in Erie County this past April when he did not tuck in pants or spray before heading into our Easter Road Woods. We sent the tick to technology for its universal tick test. The results surprised us. It tested negative for Lyme, but positive for Anaplasma, the bacterium that causes anaplasmosis. The laboratory uses PCR-based testing to look for genetic material from multiple pathogens. Depending upon the testing panel, that can include organisms associated with Lyme disease, Anaplasma, Babesiosis, relapsing fever, Bartonella, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and other rickettsial diseases and tularemia. There's also an important distinction between exposure and diagnosis. A positive result means the pathogen was detected in the tick. It does not prove that it was transmitted to the person who was bitten, and tick testing isn't a substitute for medical evaluation or appropriate patient testing. But imagine the difference that that information can make. Without testing my husband's tick, we might have been focused solely on Lyme disease. Instead, we knew that the tick that actually bit him contained anaplasma. We could take that report to his healthcare provider and have a much more informed conversation about potential exposure, symptoms to watch for, and appropriate care. That's why my advice after a known bite remains: remove the tick correctly, save it, document the date and location of the bite, have the tick tested, and contact your healthcare provider promptly to discuss prophylactic treatment rather than simply waiting to see whether you become sick because bacteria replicates every 28 days. Save the laboratory report. A tick is tiny, but the information carries can be enormous. As noted in a previous column, there are several tick labs. The report reference here is from Ticknology 970-305-5587. I want my kids outside playing. In the yard, climbing trees and getting dirty. How do I protect them from ticks without making them afraid to go outdoors? Please send them outside. Let them climb trees, play soccer, go camping, explore the woods, and come home dirty. But be preventative and vigilant. Tick awareness shouldn't take childhood away from our children. But knowing what our family knows now, there are some things I would do very differently. I recently had a supendicious conversation with our now 26-year-old daughter and a dear teacher friend we ran into who had attended our benefit when care costs for our then 13 and 14-year-old rocketed into five digits. She had lost approximately a continuous 2 years of her life to tick-borne disease. We were discussing her medical history and testing, which suggested her infections may have been acquired 4 to 5 years before her illness became debilitating. Wow. My former colleague asked her where she thought she was infected. She immediately said summer camp. She had attended an overnight summer camp when she was about 10. She remembers spending her days outside around horses, grass, and wooded areas, but she doesn't remember checking herself for ticks, doing anything preventative, being told to check, or having counselors routinely talk about ticks. Can we prove that's where she was bitten? No. But the conversation stopped me in my tracks. Oh, the guilt. But we didn't know then what we know now. Now consider the other story. Consider the other end of our family story. Our younger daughter, who experienced tick-borne illness herself as a child, is now a camp counselor. She talks to her campers about ticks, reminds them to check themselves every day, and has them shower before bed. That's what progress looks like to me. It isn't keeping children indoors. It's awareness, education, and vigilance. Parents can make tick prevention as routine as sunscreen applied, after tick spray, or a bike helmet. Use an age-appropriate EPA-registered repellent on exposed skin according to the label. 20% Picaridin product like All Clean Feel. Have designated outdoor clothing, socks, and shoes treated with permethrin for outdoor activities. Following product directions, teach children what ticks look like and where they hide. When they come inside, check clothing and gear, shower, and perform a careful head-to-toe tick check. Camp counselors, coaches, teachers, and other adults supervising children outdoors can help too. A simple reminder Everyone do your tick check tonight. Maybe something a child remembers long after camp ends. There is one childhood activity I personally no longer recommend. Jumping in piles of leaves. I know. It's practically a rite of fall. But black-legged ticks thrive in humid leaf litter, which provides exactly the protected environment they need. Knowing how tiny a nymph can be, approximately the size of a poppy seed, I don't think intentionally burying a child's body and hair in leaf litter is worth the risk. There are 100 other ways to enjoy fall. And that's because particularly important as we move through the last month of summer towards fall. Tick prevention doesn't end when school starts. Adult black-legged ticks become particularly active again in the fall, and ticks can remain active whenever conditions permit. The answer isn't fear. Let them play. Let them explore. Let them get dirty. But teach them what we didn't know years ago. Protect yourself before you go out. Check yourself when you come in. Shower and speak up if you find a tick. If today's children grow up thinking a tick check is simply what you do after playing outside, we've accomplished something important. Awareness doesn't keep children out of nature. It helps them enjoy it more safely. Checklist. Repellent before outdoor activities. Avoid leaf litter and brush when possible. Tick check every evening. Shower before bed. Tell an adult immediately if a tick is found. Stay tuned next week for information on pets and more. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the East Aurora Advertiser on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Inaugural Dick Gallagher kickoff classic set for Labor Day weekend. Western New York High School football will open its 2026 season with a new four-game showcase honoring one of the sport's longtime advocates. Western New York athletes will host the inaugural Dick Gallagher kickoff classic on Friday, September 4th and Saturday, September 5th, featuring matchups between several of the region's top public and private school programs. The event is being presented in partnership with the University of Buffalo and SUNY Erie. The schedule includes Lancaster versus McQuaid of Rochester, 6 p.m. Friday at UB's Broadview Stadium, St. Francis versus Bennett, yay Bennett, 9 p.m. Friday at UB's Broadview Stadium, Bishop Tyman versus University Prep of Rochester, 1 p.m. Saturday at SUNY Erie North, and Canisius versus Health Science at 6 p.m. Saturday at SUNY Erie North. The event honors the late Dick Gallagher, a longtime promoter and advocate of Western New York high school sports, who is known by many as the patron saint of Western New York high school sports. Dick always wanted that private versus public game that first week of the season, said Frank Wolf, founder of WNY Athletics, Tom Prince of Western New York Athletes, and Gallagher was a mentor to both him and Wolf and helped inspire the creation of WNY Athletics. This is something he just always wanted to see happen. Always wanted to see this happen. And now it's happening, Prince said. These matchups are crazy. We may see the biggest crowds we've seen in high school football since back before we even knew what WNY Athletics was. Gallagher was a member of the Greater Buffalo Sports Hall of Fame and the Section V1 Hall of Fame. He founded Western New York High School Sports, a publication devoted to local high school football that ran from 1983 to 2010. He also established the Western New York High School All-Academic Team, which recognized more than 300 local scholar athletes annually in sports including baseball, softball, football, and basketball. In 1987, he organized the All Academic Sports Banquet. Gallagher also served as executive director of the Alcohol and Drug Dependency Services and Kids Escaping Drugs. Among his accomplishments was the development of Renaissance House, a 30-bed treatment facility for teenagers. Coast Cares Education opened to benefit school districts. Coast Professional Inc. will hold its fourth annual Coast Cares Education Open on Thursday, August 27th at Batavia Country Club. The golf tournament benefits the Geneseo, Mount Morris, Perry, and York Central School Districts. According to the company, the annual event has raised more than $100,000 for local schools since it began. Registration will open at 8 a.m., followed by a 9 a.m. shotgun start. This year's tournament marks the first time the event will be held at Batavia Country Club. Jonathan Prince, Coast Chef Executive Officer, said the company remains committed to supporting the school districts that serve many of its employees and families. Whole sponsorships available for $100 and raffle prize donations will be accepted through August 13th. Businesses and community members interested in supporting the event may contact Coast at Golf Tournament at coastprofessional.com. Glory Days softball heads to semifinal games. Team Labatt at Mister's Bar and Stage finished their regular season with a 14-9 win versus the Doodahs of Wally Wynn's Hotel. Wally's jumped out to a 4-1 lead powered by big hits from Jim Reagan, Mark Majewski, and Marty Hackford. Pete Peterman and Don Janish kept the Wally's offense rolling with five more runs in the later innings. The Doodahs soft team would like to thank Ben Holmes of Wally Wise for another year of sportsmanship and support. Still the best food in town. Team Labatt eventually poured on the offense to help overcome a shaky pitching performance by Rick Edwards. Contributing three hits each were Dan Suter, Brett Schoenwetter, and Keith Cross. Paul and Rocco Rokita had two clutch hits and was equally dynamic from his left field position where he made three running catches. The evening concluded with a league party sponsored by Dexter Martin of Team Labatt. Team Labatt would like to thank Dylan Smith and Ryan Kanowski of Misters for their generosity and support. Woohoo! Shunks versus Builders won. The first round of the Glory Days 60-plus League playoffs saw Dex Unlimited hosting Shunks Bat Pack on Diamond 3. The Builders wasted no time, erupting for five runs in the first inning, three more in the second, and four in the third to take firm control of the game. Shunks chipped away with single runs in the second, fourth, and sixth, but Dex offense never let up. Every player in the lineup recorded at least two hits, and Rick Edwards delivered a strong pitching performance to secure the win. Leading the hit parade for Dex were Dave Rusin, 4-5, Edwards, 44, Joe McCooey, 44, with a triple. Shunks were paced by Gary Steinmetz, 2-3, Golf Hicks, 2-3, and Bill Bonkow, who added a home run. Next up for Dex, the Mogs. Builders 2 versus Basil Chevy. Builders 2 jumped out to a 2-0 lead in the bottom of the first. Jamie opened the inning with a double. Phil drove him in, and Mike followed by knocking in clock. Basil Chevrolet answered in the top of the second when Dan Kerman ripped the triple and John Foray singled him home. Builders 2 responded immediately in their half of the second. Jamie led off with a single, two walks followed, and delivered another RBI single. Basil counted with two more runs of their own on John Mecca single and a Willie Wilson RBI double. Wilson then turned heads by hustling to third on a delayed throw, and when Builders 2 hesitated retrieving the ball, Wilson sprinted home to score. Woo, yeah! They did slow builders the second, who added two more in the at the bottom of the third to go 5-3. Steve collected both RBIs, smashing a double over Sammy in left field. Builders two kept. In the fourth inning, Mark singled manager Ron, followed with the hit, and Craig drove in. That would be the final scoring for Builders 2 as Basil Chevrolet mounted their comeback late. One run in the sixth and two more in the seventh to tie the game at 6-6. With two outs in the seventh, Bob lofted a short pop-up he assumed would land foul, but he collided with the Builders 2 catcher, sparking an uproar from both benches as Basil took the field for the bottom of the inning in a tie game. Basil helped Builders to scoreless in the 6th, 7th, and 8th despite missing star shortstop Lance. John stepped in at short, and John made his season debut at second without missing a beat. In the top of the 8th, Wilson tripped and Jeff drove him in for the go-ahead run. Builders 2 collected three hits in the bottom of the 8th, but three flies out in the threat ceiling. A 7-6 Basil Chevy victory, their second one-run win over Builders 2 in a week. Standout hitters for Basil included Wilson and Diaz, both going 3-for-4, with Wilson adding a double, triple, and RBI. Go ahead on with your bad self. Ferre, Coran, and Madison each finished 2-for-3, and Madison also drew a walk. Only Loco Joe posted a perfect line, going 3-for-3 in his first playoff game with Basil. Basil Chevrolet now advances to face legends in the 2026 playoff semifinals. In the classifieds, the deadline is 9 a.m. on Tuesdays. You can call them at 716-652-0320 or email info@eastauroranY.com. In the classifieds, you can find home improvement on an aging roof, prepare for power outages. You can prepare for power outages. Do you know what's in your water? You can do leaf home water. Home improvement, try Safe Step, North America's walk-in tub. You can find a word scrabble. You can find Auden, A-U-D-I-E-N, hearing, the world's first hearing aid with touchscreen controls. Miscellaneous, you have consumer cellular, the same reliable nationwide coverage as the largest carriers. You have real estate. We buy homes for cash as is. No repairs, no fuss, any condition. Easy three-step process, call, get cash offer, and get paid. Get your fair cash offer today by calling Liz Buys Houses at 1-888-704-5670. We have different type of services like pest control, protect your home from pests safely, affordably, roaches, bed bugs, rodents, termites, spiders, and other pests. Locally owned and affordable. Call for service or inspection today. 1-877-290-0023. Have zip code of property ready when calling. We'll sell your vehicle for only $46. If you want to sell your vehicle, we'll run your vehicle in the East Aurora Advertiser, Herald Courier, and Springville Journal, no matter how long it takes. To sell your vehicle, call 716-652-0320. Applies to private individuals only. No businesses. Maximum of 20 words. Must call monthly to renew. Here are some of the vehicles for sale: a 2016 Kia Sorento, a 1975 TRC, a 2017 Nissan Sentra SR, a 2014 Buick Regal Premium All-Wheel Drive, a 1927 Model T, a 1994 Kodak 33000 GVW, a 1979 Honda CB750, a 1985 Kawasaki 700 LTD, a Harley-Davidson Super Glide, a 1996, a 2004 Harley-Davidson Heritage Softail, and a 2004 Yamaha Classic V-Star 1100, and in 2008, a Yamaha V-Star 650 Silverado, a 2013 Dutchman Kodak, a 2005 Jayco Designer, a 2016 Forest River Wildwood X Lite, and a 2018 Trail Runner 325 ODK Camper. Excellent condition. Support your local paper. When you support local news, you support your local community. If you would like to know more about advertising opportunities that benefit your business and help support the community, contact a sales rep by calling 716-652-0320 or email ads@eastaroranewyork.com. Select Door is now hiring. We are the leading designer and manufacturer of premium grade hardwood doors, and we are growing. We are currently looking, seeking experienced craftsmen to join our production team. Pay and benefits salary starting at $19 an hour and up to depending on experience, time off, PTO time, health and wellness, health, dental, and vision insurance, retirement, 401k with company match, education and experience, a high school diploma or GED is a plus, prior experience in woodworking or carpentry is a plus, but we are willing to train the right individual, the right entry-level candidates, knowledge and skills and abilities, basic knowledge of woodworking or carpentry tools, ability to safely operate and set up machinery, equipment, good math skills, strong commitment to safe work habits, certified forklift training is a plus. Compensation and schedule, pay rate, $19 to $24 an hour. Oh, that was for the craftsman. Oh, for the glass technician, they have even more things. They have a compensation and schedule. Their pay rate is $19 to $24 an hour. Position summary, cut and or installate glass, make and install metal grids and glass, perform sandblast, time off, PTO, health and wellness, same thing, health, dental, and vision, insurance, retirement, 401k with company match, education and experience, high school diploma or GED is plus, experience progression, cut and insulate rectangular pieces, sandblasting, cut and insulate curved pieces and grid work. Knowledge and skills and abilities, math skills sufficient for the following, development and use of jigs, ability to use templates, ability to read shop order, attention to detail, knowledge of glass safety. Give Karen, send Karen your resume at karen.kolesar@selectcustomdoor.com. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features. From the Thursday, August 13, 2026 issue of the East Aurora Advertiser. We read from the East Aurora Advertiser every Saturday at 10 a.m. Your reader has been Janice Marie Hunt. Thank you for listening.
Coming up next on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service, we have a reading of the Niagara Gazette. At noon, we have the Dunkirk Observer. And at 1 o'clock, we have some of our Northtown Bees, including Amherst, Clarence, Cheektowaga, Lancaster, and Depew. Stay with us for these readings and more throughout the day. You're listening to the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. As of this year, our agency has broadcast more than 300,000 hours of radio readings. Volunteer radio readers read newspapers, magazines, and books to area people who are blind or have a print disability, who are provided reading radios. Radio readings broadcast. The following program is intended for listeners who are blind, have low vision, or have another print disability, which makes